You're listening to A Views and Brews, recorded live at the Cactus Cafe in Austin, Texas. Find out how you can join us for a live show at the Cactus at cactuscafe.org.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cactus Cafe. I'm Rebecca McEnroe with KUT. Typically, I host Views and Brews, but tonight I'm turning it over to a fantastic guest host. I was trying to think about how to introduce this host, and I kept coming back to Harold Pinter's Nobel speech that he gave. And a small part of that made me think of the work that Yaqui does, and I'd just like to read that tonight, where Harold Pinter said, "When we look into a mirror, we think the image that confronts us is accurate. But move a millimeter and that image changes. We are actually looking at a never-ending range of reflections. But sometimes an artist needs to smash the mirror. For it is on the other side of that mirror that the truth stares at us." And I've known Yaqui for a long time. He was in graduate school with my ex-husband. The films that he has made and the perspective that he brings to the world have constantly smashed the mirror. And they bring us a truth that we desperately need. He is now the Associate Dean of Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion at the Moody Theater. He's also an Associate Professor of RTF. Ladies and gentlemen, Yaqui Smith.
Good evening, everyone. First, thank you so much for being here with us tonight. So I am not as eloquent as Ms. Rebecca there, but I'm going to try. And I want to introduce my panelists here who have come to talk tonight about race and diversity on this campus, on UT's campus.
This isn't about football?
Oh, no.
Oh,
this is the wrong
one.
Wrong one.
She's ready. I'm out.
And I want to start to my right here. We have Dr. Edmund T. Gordon, who is a professor of African and African Diaspora Studies and Anthropology and the Vice Provost for Diversity here at UT Austin. So please give him a hand. We have Mr. Roger Reeves here. He is an award-winning poet and an associate professor of English here at UT. Give him a hand. We have Ms. Virginia Cumberbatch. She is the director of UT's Community Engagement Center. Give her a hand. And we have Ms. Kathleen McElroy. She is a former writer and editor for the New York Times, and she is the director of UT's School of Journalism. And a full professor. There you go. So I wanted to start tonight, kind of talking to everyone here. I wanted to talk about an article that was released about a month ago. And it chronicled UT's troubling past starting in the mid-50s, of using standardized testing scores as a weapon against admitting African-American students into the university. And there was something in there, and I kind of want to read from it, and I'll kind of skim through. But it quotes, "The committee went on to observe that if the 2,700-person freshman class was admitted, according to state population proportions, 300 would be black. And it noted that the white UT freshman has significantly higher aptitude test scores than incoming freshmen at three Texas black colleges." And then it goes on to say this, "If, assuming the distributions are representative, the cutting point would tend to result in a maximum of 70 Negroes in a class of about 2,700, right? So this equals to about 2.5% of the student body being black, right? And I bring that up because today, right, we're sitting here at UT at around 4 to 5%, right? It fluctuates. And now we're talking about something that was going on in the mid-1950s. And I want to start with you, Dr. Gordon. How are we still here? Because 2.5 to 4 is not really that big of a jump. How are we still here?
It's twice as much. What more do you want?
Well, how do we combat this? What do we do?
Well, the first thing you have to recognize is that we've been stuck at just below 5% for about 20, 25 years, right? So we made, if you want to call it progress, we made steady progress up until like 96 when we had the Hopwood decision, then things went down for a while, and then we got on this new way of determining how folks could get in. So we had the 10% plan, so things went back up. But we've been stuck at around mid-fours. I think this last year we brought in enough black folks to be about 5.1%. Now, that only happens if you include not just the people who say they're black in their application, but also the people who say they're black and anything else mixed in. They automatically get counted as black as well. If you didn't use them, then we'd be at 4.2, 4.1, something like that. So how did that happen? Well, this is institutional racism. I thought you knew that kind of stuff went on. This is how things operate. I thought for a long time that there was actually a quota, right, of around 5%. Because, there's still maybe, it may be an unspoken one. I'm in the provost office, so I'm certainly going to get my head cut off for this. But if you look at the percentages who would come in, if we only admitted based on the top 10%, which is actually now the top 6%, it's the top 6% because if they took in the top 10%, it would be the entirety of UT's entering class every year. So they lowered to 6% so that it's only 75% of the entering class. In terms of African Americans, in the top 10%, of those who get admitted and decide to come, we're 7% of that population. So where we lose out, if you want to call it that, is in the open admissions for the 25%, where those folks are overwhelmingly white. I guess there's no other way to say it. And so basically what happens is it's the numbers are getting adjusted. Now whether that's whether that is intentional or not is an open issue. One of the problems that UT has is those percentages for undergraduates are inelastic. If you look at it, we're in a situation where African Americans are about 5%, while in the state we're 12.8%, something like that. Hispanic or Latinx students are somewhere around this year, I think it's close to 24%, 23 someplace in there.
And the state is 39.
All right, state is 39. Okay. White students in the entering class were 37%, right? I think overall they're 42%. We are no longer a majority-minority. We're now a majority-minority, at least undergraduate. And Asian American students are somewhere around 20%. So where are you going to reduce in order to push up the percentages of African Americans? So there's an issue there that if you really want to get down and dirty, we could actually talk about. But there's an issue there. In other words, one of the reasons why black percentages can't come up is because at this point you're at a place where you're going to have to reduce somebody else's percentage, and there's just so far to go. I'll leave you with one other thing in terms of that. I think the only solution to these kind of problems is not having quality education be a scarce resource, and not have it be a zero-sum game in terms of who gets access to such an education. But well, I'll leave that for today.
And, I'm glad that you brought that up, because then it makes me ask the question, what can a university like UT, right, what can UT do actually in terms of outreach, in terms of figuring out a way to actually help with the education system in, poor communities, and then also actually go out and like do outreach to actually bring those students in? Because I think a lot of students, right, believe that they can't even get in. So some aren't even applying, right, because historically they've been left out. So what can we do in order to sort of combat that?
Yeah, I can share a little bit about what we're doing within the Division of Diversity and Community Engagement. So we have a component of that is UT Outreach, which is run by Patrick Patterson, which really focuses on, in the state of Texas, working with schools that have been identified as underperforming or underrepresented. And there's locations all around the state, and sort of what that is doing is helping to rectify this idea that we're not just waiting, right, until students, are trying to apply, but we're really helping to disrupt the pipeline. And how are we helping students matriculate to not just UT, but any institution? And so I think that is sort of the key focus, is that this isn't just around how are we helping to diversify the University of Texas, how are we helping to reconcile sort of the undereducation of communities of color as a whole? And so I think part of that program is making sure even if you don't end up at UT, are you ending up somewhere? And are you being supported in that process? Because we all know it's not just about the X's and O's of your application or your essay. It's, you know, does your family able collectively to fill out a FAFSA? You know, does your family even know, is it better to go to a place like UT or is it better to go to a, you know, a community college and then transfer? What are the economics about that? I mean, that opts people out of the process altogether because there's this sort of, this racialized knowledge around what the college experience is like. But I did want to touch base a little bit on your first question around, you know, how did we get here? And I think, yes, a lot of it is around sort of the admissions numbers and how we played around with it. But I think part of this is that, you know, we haven't done all the work necessary to rectify and reconcile the legacy of racism at this university. I had the pleasure of co-authoring a book around the precursors who were the first African Americans to enter UT. And when you think about the policies and the practices that were set into motion in 1950 when Heman Sweat was admitted, till now, we haven't done the work to undo or dismantle those policies or practices. They've just kind of been an undercurrent. And so when you talk to students, I'm a native Austinite, so, you know, I'm like a black unicorn in this city. And
in many ways.
Yeah, so take a photo, tell a friend you saw a black unicorn. And, you know, I'm actually the product of a UT law grad. But, and so I knew the ins and outs of what it was like when my father moved from New York City down here, that the legacy of what it's like to be on campus, you know, and the sort of the culpability, I don't think we've fully addressed that. I think we're doing great work to do that, but that's part of not just students being admitted, students of color being admitted, but wanting to come here, wanting to be a part of this community.
And if I could follow up on that, 40 plus years ago, I was at accepted at University of Texas and at Texas A&M, and I chose to go to A&M because I would rather face what was going to be in front of me than the legacy of UT's racism. It wasn't the overt stuff, and I figured I couldn't handle that. You know, if you're going to vote Janis Joplin the third ugliest co-ed or the second ugliest co-ed, which this school did, then how am I going to survive that as an awkward black woman? So to her point, and that's the thing that we've got to understand, it's not just, oh, things are better now, but all of these institutions, the culture remains in so many ways.
Can I jump? It's interesting because I was a college athlete, and so I follow athletics. And I don't know if the pass home game honored the 1969 national champion. Do we know the significance of the 1969 national championship team at UT?
Yeah.
It was the last all-white, non-integrated football team. Right? National champion. We just honored them this past Saturday at halftime. And in fact, the uniforms were supposed to be throwback uniforms to that 69 era. Now, if I'm a black athlete and I'm aware of this legacy, how does that feel to put on that uniform?
But they're not.
Right?
They're not aware.
They may not be aware, but this is one of the issues that I think is carrying forth. Right? We don't have a nuanced way of dealing with the legacy. Right? We have to be able to say, okay, what do we do with that? What do we do with the fact that there are records of past ADs talking about not wanting to integrate sports, right? We have to sort of be able to deal with the sort of fullness of what does it mean to be currently a member of the UT community, right? And I think we always want to sort of obfuscate that or say, oh, look, we're doing better now. But are we really, if we're not actually grappling with these things and we're sort of instantiating them, even in these more benign ways?
And that's such a great point because it brings me to you because, you know, you were a student here, MFA and PhD. And I guess my question becomes, do you see any change in terms of the way that black and brown students are supported, are treated, are undergirded at this university now than when you were actually a student here?
So I want to celebrate and sort of recognize the sort of beauty of the Black faculty here and the faculty of color and the way in which they do so much work to make sure students get through. And I'll give you an example. When I was a graduate student, I had just finished my MFA, which is a fine arts degree in poetry, and I was in my first year of my PhD program. And I was asked to apply to a tenure track job in Chicago. When I went and asked my alleged supporters in the English department where I was getting my PhD from for help for this, they told me I wasn't ready. I shouldn't be on the market. Now I'm a graduate student, which means I'm making $10 and I got student loan debt, right? I'm always ready for a good job. It was the Black faculty members that I went to that were like, we got you. And UT has always had that. There's always been what I would call the underground, right? The undercommons, the folks that had your back when, quite honestly, white faculty didn't. And so that was my experience then. And I wound up getting the job. And now I'm back as a professor in the same department where some of those people are like, oh, we didn't think you were ready. But what I'll say is it's also still quite difficult for students of color. I teach poetry workshops, and I had a student who was protesting the Young Republicans last year, and they do their hostile bake sale and all these different activities, and she wound up protesting them and becoming quite vocal in her protest, and she wound up receiving death threats for her protest against what she was very much in the right to be protesting. And so I think it's still quite difficult to be a student of color on this campus. I know it's difficult to be a faculty member of color on this campus. As someone who's had a death threat from a student, from a white male student, who's someone who's experienced overt racism when talking about admissions. So what keeps me here is this. Dr. Segor, it's people like this up here that actually make this place sort of something else when it gets quite ugly. But I want to celebrate what faculty of color have done and how we've thrived here despite attempts to kill us, quite honestly.
No, I was just going to say, in terms of the student experience, so I went to the LBJ school for my master's, and I was one of three Black people in my 110 cohort. There's one Black male, and kind of knew what that context was going to be like moving into it. But I think one of the things that people don't truly understand, and we haven't quite grappled with, right, is that it's not just sort of the experience of navigating sort of the academics of school, right? It's not just even sort of the microaggressions that might happen in the classroom or outside of it, but the power of the actual institution, like the physical facade of an institution that up until 2 years ago, we could say had placed in parts of the campus in celebration Confederate soldiers, right? So just thinking about the psychological, emotional impact that has on students as you're navigating a space that you're being told is for you, you're supposed to be creating a sense of belonging, and yet there's these constant reminders that at some point this space was not for you, right? And that hasn't been counterbalanced by the contributions of students, faculty of color, right? When I talk about sort of the process it took to write as we saw it, I mean, the links we had to go to find records, things that you would think we would celebrate as a university, right? In terms of when we finally integrated. We talk all the time of a story of going down to the Briscoe Center, which is the American History Center next to the LBJ Library, and asking for certain records. And I was given two thin folders, and the title on the folder was simply Negroes at UT. No names, no dates, no nothing. And that to me was such a useful tool for motivation, but also raised my consciousness to like, this is what we're dealing with, right? That we haven't even properly positioned, documented, elevated the stories, right? And so how do we use that as a tool to help students of color have a place of belonging and elevate their lived experience within this context? And so I think there is still a lot of work to be done, but I think interrogating sort of some of those practices that we have just left dormant is part of that process.
And, you know, how do we interrogate those processes? You know, I think about what you just said about this whole notion of literally, you know, what is it, 3 years ago that they took down the Confederate statues? 2 years ago. So we're literally, again, walking around and having to look at these Confederate statues every day. And that almost becomes, like you said, psychological torment, right, for a student. Some students don't even know, but that's a whole other thing. But regardless of that, those of us who do know, we know that we're sort of existing in these spaces where, in fact, historically, we have not been, you know, accepted in. And so the question becomes, for us here, how do we, right, get this word out? How do we begin to combat these things? How do we become very, very vocal about the things that we're up here talking about? Because we're talking about this now, but are we out there on the 40 acres talking about it?
I think this is where we have to point out Dr. Gordon's, you know, walk, his tour, because beyond statues, statues are almost easy. It's the stuff built into the bricks and the mortar and the pathways. And if you haven't taken his tour of, it has an official, Right, and it's now virtual. You can do that. It's an amazing way because that is what's important here. And I think what we're talking about here is actual history and collective memory, public memory. So things are baked into how we live, and we don't know how they got there. So I was telling students about how I-35 used to be the East Avenue and things like that. And the student who's a government major looked at me like, and we were getting barbecue together at Valentina's. He was like, but that's the highway that's there. I said, no, it's there for a reason. So to your point, I think we need to do a better job, like the 1619 Project, we were talking about that earlier, which points out these things are not accidental. These things are not natural. You know, if you think Google is just coming up with something when you do a search, no. I think it's time for us to really explain to students a different history. Because the history that has been taught in Texas for a very long time was hegemonic. And now we need to break down these structures to say, this is where this came from. I-35 is not going anywhere. I'm not saying tear down I-35, but people need to understand our history, Austin's history, Texas history, United States history, that these things are not accidental and they're not natural.
And as a journalist, do you think that the reporting has shifted, say, in the last decade? Do you think that there's better reporting of these things, or do you think it's gotten worse?
Okay, so when you have publications like the New York Times and the Washington Post with the resources to come up with something like the 1619 Project, which Nicole Hannah Jones had to fight for after winning the MacArthur, so, you know, she had some weight there. So the Post and the Times can do that. Can the American Statesman, does it have the resources to do something similar? Or will it, I mean, and it's trying, it's doing investigative work. But I guess my point is, a lot of the day-to-day stuff, I think, is coming from citizens. We wouldn't know that Black lives even mattered if there weren't more cameras and more citizen journalists. So I'm going to not talk about journalism anymore.
You know, in terms of sort of being a professor, you know, I'm sometimes in class and I'm the only Black face in the class. And for me, I find it to be my duty, right, to talk about certain things. Like today, I'm in there talking about redlining, right, and the insidious nature of racism. To all white faces, some seem to get it. Some are like, what is he talking about? And as a professor, are we bringing those things to the classroom, and do we find it necessary to challenge our white students and our Black students to actually think about those things in all of the work that they're creating?
I just want to say a couple things. I was at Oklahoma State before I was here, which had even fewer African Americans. Maybe it had fewer, about the same. But I taught sports journalism to white males from Oklahoma. And it was a great experience. First of all, just my being in the room was powerful. But at one point, someone said something about so-and-so being a beast or an animal. So I went up to the thing and went to Google, and I showed them pictures of slave auctions. And these students had never made the connection between calling an African-American athlete a beast and an animal. I'm not saying that they'll never do it, but at least once somebody told them that. And another time, after the Cam Newton loss in the Super Bowl, and people criticized his post-game interview, we broke it down in class. Because I haven't heard professors in the hallway talking about Cam Newton showed his true colors. Yeah, I've heard that before. And we broke it down, and we all figured out that the journalist had not asked him the right question. And 2 days later, a white student came up to me and said, you know, my dad and I were talking about that, and my dad criticized Cam. And I said, no, Dad, those sports writers didn't ask the right question. And I had given him the power to question that and to question his parents. So I just feel proud of myself. One good moment in the classroom.
Yeah, I'm teaching this class right now called Blackness in the American Imagination to undergrad, so it's pretty much what it is. But one of the things that I'm having them do that I think they found very difficult, but I think difficulty is what we're here for, actually, I had them write a racial literacy narrative, right? So I'm teaching slave narratives, and I had them write, how did they come to know themselves as being raced? Right. And for white students, that is challenging because this class may be the first time that they've realized that they are raced. Right. That they're circumscribed. And so it was a lot of fielding of questions in office hours. But, you know, you're just pushing them to sort of think about themselves. I think one of the best things that you can sort of do is to not romanticize or villainize a thing, but to reify it. Right, is to reify blackness, to reify white. So often what happens is right now in our sort of, we're in this woke stage, right? We're in the, everybody's woke, right? So everybody has the sort of PC position down. And I think that we've lost nuance and we actually don't know what we really mean. And so what I'm trying to do in this class is unseat, right, our key terms, right? Everybody can throw out like, white supremacy, but do they really know what that is? Do they really know the insidious nature? Are they seeing it in their everyday lives? Are they seeing it in the way they may sort of participate in certain things that don't feel like white supremacy? For instance, a football game and singing the Eyes of Texas, right? There's all these ways in which we're participating, proliferating these things. So I'm just trying to draw my students' attention to sort of, you can't grow up in America and not be racist. You can't grow up in America and not be sexist. You can't grow up in America and not be homophobic. That's quite difficult to escape. It's going to be a process of tearing that stuff up and resurrecting the ways in which we're born with these things. We're not born, we're raised with them. Right? So that's what I think I'm trying to do in class, which is, you know.
No, it's interesting because then, you know, for me, I'm going to take this outside of class because when you start thinking about the insidious nature of racism, for me, what it does is it makes me, as a black man, actually sometimes believe that the things that have happened to me and the ways in which I'm viewed are actually my fault, right? Because it doesn't come with context. So this whole example of, all right, I grew up in the projects and I see people selling drugs and people fighting in schools and people not having a good education, I begin to blame myself for those things, right? Because nobody's actually told me that these are social structures created to keep me in place. And so I'm wondering, right, now to you, in terms of the work that you're doing like in East Austin, right, how are you, again, dealing with that there? And then what is that relationship to what you're doing in East Austin? And how does that sort of come back to what's going on at UT in terms of maybe admissions, in terms of creating a bridge between literally East Austin, which is a stone's throw away from us, to UT?
Yeah. No, I mean, first of all, I want to sort of give credit to sort of how this work was birthed. So the Division of Diversity, it's in its 12th year of existence and was really brainchild of the late President Powers, and really to sort of help grapple with two spaces. One, what's the campus culture? How do we start to interrogate, building a more diverse and inclusive campus. What does that look like? And that it's not just admissions, that what happens when they get to campus, right? How are we creating and curating spaces of belonging and then also putting people in place to challenge policies and procedures? And so that was the first mandate. And then the second part is what I have the pleasure of participating in, which is community engagement. And it was really to ask these questions. What is the point of a top-tier research institution if the work that we do doesn't have an impact in the community? What's the point in having all of this thought leadership live in some academic journal if it's not being utilized to dismantle some of the systems that we're perpetuating in this city? And so how do we become less of an ivory tower and more of a community anchor? And so it was interesting when I came into this position, you know, the rhetoric that was being used was like, yeah, we got to rebuild our relationship with East Austin. I was like, rebuild? Let's start with build. There's no restoration to be done. We just need to create it. And that truly was sort of the attitude, you know, and, you know, we oftentimes just sort of geographically pin this to East Austin, but I think it's important that we realize that Black and brown communities are around the city. In fact, if we go back to this idea of freedom towns, I'm sure hopefully most of you guys know that Austin's the first site of freedom towns in the state of Texas, but they were all over Austin, South Austin, East Austin, North Austin. But part of the tension was that UT was this sort of off-limit space, both physically as well as intellectually. That if you guys, one of the things that I was sort of told a few that I never noticed was that it was only until last year that there's actually any physical external signage that tells you you are at the University of Texas. Which I think says something psychologically, which means you know where you are if you're supposed to be here, right? And this idea of sort of who gets to navigate this space and who doesn't. And this idea of how do we use those resources and how do we recalibrate this idea of, you know, not having mutually beneficial research, right? We go in, we use the community as a laboratory, we go out, we never do anything to bring resources back to the community, but thank you for your time and being in our survey. And so helping to recalibrate all of those practices that had really made us in some ways complicit and culpable in the systemic issues that we see facing our city. You know, it's really easy for students to come to Austin or come to UT and for us to move here and be the fastest growing city in America that's so liberal and so progressive. And that narrative has protected us for so long. It's become this facade that we haven't dealt with the fact that we're the most economically segregated city in the country of a city our size, that the insidiousness and pervasiveness of the 1928 plan did not just die off. Like, we're dealing with the remnants of that today. It's in every vertical system, healthcare, education, housing, right? And so the work that we're doing is helping to, one, just identify that those things exist and helping to elevate the narrative that, you know, we can't be a progressive and liberal city and, you know, creative if we're not helping to deal with how we reconcile the housing crisis that we're in, and that it is majority impacting communities of color who are being re-traumatized because they were forced to move to that part of the city in 1928, right? And now we're re-forcing them back out to, you know, the suburbs. And so some of the work that we're doing is really to provide space for those conversations to take place and to figure out what our role is in co-laboring with them. I think one of the things that we've been really adamant about is that our job at the University of Texas is not to come in and solve problems. One, because we don't have all the answers. Two, we don't have all the resources. But three, the community is our best resource for solving these community issues, right? That lived experience is just as critical as the research and thought leadership happening on campus. So how do we co-labor in order to figure out ways that we can dismantle some of these inequitable systems and practices? And so we've been doing that particularly in housing right now. We have the community housing hub that we just launched that focuses on advocacy and preservation, realizing that there's a critical part of this housing conversation is preserving the legacy of the people who built those communities, that it's not just sort of the X's and O's of taxes, and then doing that also sort of in the health conversation. And I think we relate that back to the dynamic and relationship of UT because One, UT students are a part of this conversation of gentrification, right, and displacement, but also because UT, we have been culpable. You know, we didn't just build a baseball field because someone donated land. We took that land, right, through questionable practices. And so we have to be not only transparent about that history, but be willing to do the hard work to reconcile that history.
But what happens, right? You know, we have these conversations. We have these talks. There's a whole sort of thing even around the country right now about diversity and inclusion and equity, right? Which these are great conversations that we have. But how do we put these things into practice, right? When we start to talk about, you know, like better health care and better housing, who are we actually going to? Not just the community, but who are we trying to like go to and say, look, it is your responsibility to fix this because you messed it up. Who are we talking to? And even on this campus, who are we going to and say, it's your responsibility to fix this because, again, you created this ivory tower, as you keep saying. Dr. Gordon. I'm saying it's your responsibility. I'm asking you, what can I do?
Well, there are people who have the power, if you want to call it that, to be able to not completely fix it, but to make it better. But that's not how things usually work. The way things usually work is when the folks who are aggrieved get themselves together, analyze their situation, and force those folks who have more power and agency than they do to do something about it. So every single thing that's been achieved on this campus in terms of, well, this is about race and ethnicity, in terms of black and brown folks, departments and centers and numbers and, you know, even the issue of, you know, percentages of undergraduates, that has come basically from students getting together, making an analysis of their situation, deciding that there's an unjust situation, and taking action on the basis of it. So it's, you know, power, what is it? Frederick does it, say, you're the poet, what do you say? It's, a, you know, power only concedes to demand or something like that. But whatever it is, nobody's going to give you anything unless you demand it and, you know, be vocal about it and show the injustice that's there. So that's you know, that's the situation.
I do want to inject here about journalism, and that's the work of the Daily Texan. It's done partnerships with the National Association of Black Journalists chapter and the National Association of Hispanic Journalists. It's been working with the LGBTQ plus community. It's been working with Asian American journalists, and I'm sorry if I got initials wrong. It's been a long day. I apologize. But the fact is that they are exposing this, and the administration does pay attention. Today's story on Latino professors and pay. So I just want to give a shout out to students who do care about the world they're in.
So mobilize, educate, make noise.
Just say something about that. I agree with that. But the folks who brought that to the Daily Texan were the Latinx faculty, right? In other words,
right,
people advocating for themselves. You can't sit back and let, you know,
oh,
other folks
absolutely
are not going to do it for you. So
you got it. Yes, that's part of the process. Activate.
Mm-hmm. I think on the community side, I mean, you know, through the Center for Community Engagement, we've been really working, you know, yes, the community is the space that we go to first because they know their lived experience best. But, you know, holding institutions responsible, and that's not just UT, but the city of Austin. So myself and two other faculty members, Dr. Eric Tang and Peniel Joseph, sit on the Mayor's Task Force for Institutional Racism and Systemic Bias, and holding the city accountable, right? Because moving that machine of that sort of, again, that narrative of being progressive and liberal, right, needs to hold weight with what we're seeing happening in housing and our job market and our education and health. And that was a big move to use those exact words to name a task force, right? But it has to go beyond the rhetoric of just naming it that, right? But who do we hold accountable for the ways in which we're dealing with systemic racism and institutional bias? And so from there, you know, particularly in the housing conversation, that you know, we have to make a decision as a city, right? Are we going to be a city of equity or not? And then that becomes a conversation where we start holding developers responsible and the city responsible for what are the tax breaks they're giving people, right? Instead of building affordable housing, right? To build another $1 million condo. And so, you know, the work I think that we've done is really to connect sort of the research that's being done here at UT with community organizations on the ground that are holding these institutions and these policymakers accountable. One of the great organizations we've partnered with is Measure Austin, which was really birthed out of this idea of how do we hold APD accountable? They're not giving us the numbers and data fast enough, so we're going to just build the data ourselves. And then that's become the space and the model that the city of Austin has been using. So, you know, just as Dr. Gordon is saying, it's student-led. I would argue that it's being community-led in partnership with some of these systems that have proven themselves to want to pursue equity.
And I would also say we shouldn't silo the race question, right? Like, I think it actually connects to, like, homelessness and what's going on right now in the debate of with homelessness and the homeless population in Austin, right? There's a way in which we see these things as, like, oh, we have the homeless population, then we have, like, the black folks, and then we have, like, the brown folks, and then we have, like, the queer folks. And it's actually these, we need to be thinking about alliances and thinking about sort of coming to each other's sort of party to some degree and sort of helping each other in these moments because they're actually connected, right? Like, when we're talking about housing issues in Austin, particularly, like, these are connected. And so one of the things that I want to make sure we do, too, is not to sort of, not that we're doing this, but to really think broadly about blackness, right, and broadly about diversity, right, to also think about economics, to also think about gender, right,
and
in these ways.
And to your point, though, one of my personal hangups is that diversity is defined by the dominant group. That's their kind of kind word for you others, however other you may be, you know. So one of the things, to your point, I don't know if it's like coalitions or whatever, and I love the fact that I'm looking at a room of advocates, right? I'm looking at a room of allies. And I think what we need to do is how do we make this a quote-unquote better place without having to force a label on all of us. And this label has been forced because people weren't going to do it otherwise. I understand that. But if you think about it, diversity is because we're different. So I just think it just goes to some kind of language that we're still trapped in.
Which I think is why it's really important, because even if we were to ascend to this sort of utopian, whatever even numbers look like right on campus or even in the city of Austin, right? Diversity does not equate to equity naturally, right? That's the work that has to be done afterwards. And so that's why it's so important that it's not enough to just, you know, tweak our process, right? Even in admissions, to just admit students of color, but have we even done the work to create an environment where they would thrive, where they would be able to leave here with a similar, if not better, experience, right, than their white counterparts. And I think the same is to be said about Austin is, you know, there's a reason why in the mid-2000s, black and brown communities were being depleted. And it wasn't just the housing market, right? It was also this sense that the city of Austin was not a space that had deemed itself hospitable, that's a good word, hospitable to those communities. And I think, you know, back to the point around this, these intersectionalities, right, that all these things are connected and all these things help create intention with the type of campus and city that we want it to be. And so if we're not willing to co-labor with one another in spaces that don't necessarily directly impact us, right, I don't know if we'll get there. And I was talking to a colleague and we were talking about even changing the language of allyship to agitator. Like, allyship sometimes even feels a little bit sort of stagnant, right? And like, are you willing to agitate with me, not just be, you know, in a comfortable position? Because a lot of this work takes you being uncomfortable and being willing to wade into those waters of discomfort.